episode 9 of the Improvised Music Agenda. You hear back there, Jonathan Lindhorst. Let's check out some more. Welcome everyone. So this week's conversation is with Canadian saxophonist Jonathan Lindhorst, who by now lives in Berlin. If you're a regular listener to this show, you might have realised I've not posted an episode in a while. Nothing bad's happened, I've just been really busy, which is cool, but not cool for the podcast, I guess. So yeah, like a whole bunch of gigs, a couple of recording sessions which have been fun, one with Michael D'Souza as a sideman to his band, along with Jay Davis. Actually, I recorded little bits of material when I was there for the podcast, so hopefully that'll be seeing the light of day at some point of the next few months or year. And also I have been recording my own project with George Crowley and Devin Gray. That was the other day, so I'm recording this now, and that was fun, but more news will come from that in the next few months. So it's good to be back and to find time again to edit this. Yeah, so I recorded this conversation when I was over in Berlin back in February 2018. And if you listen back to a previous episode with Peter Van Huffel, that was around the same trip. So I think I recorded this the day before I recorded Peter's. But yeah, so me and John, we go a fair bit back because we met on a summer school called Jim's, which was in Salzburg. That was summer 2008. So the cool thing was, back then, I had really heavy Welsh accent and no one really understood me. But Jonathan was the only person who understood me, so he became sort of my interpreter in a way. So we became friends really quickly. So he's a great musician. He has lived also in New York before he moved to Berlin. And yeah, so he's got loads of great insights and stuff. So we talk a bit about moving around and about growing up with music. Yeah, so but if you do get a chance, please check out his music. He has a record called Limerence, which is with a Canadian band. So that's available via his Bandcamp. I'll put the links in the description. And also the track you heard up top was from his new trio project, which is not yet released. I think that's pretty new. So that's, so basically, keep an eye out for that. Another thing to keep an eye out for, in terms of Jonathan as well, he's coming over to the UK. So that's going to be in September, so we're going to do a few shows in London. We're going to do a quartet with John, guitar player, Chris Guilfoyle, who's from Ireland, and friend of the podcast, Simon Roth. So, exciting news, me and Simon were starting a new night called Shelf Life. So, there'll be more details to follow, but please put the date in your diary, September 18th, which is a Tuesday. Also, I'd like to thank Christian Pryor as well. So, he lent me a microphone so I can record this. So when I flew over, I had some just handheld mics, some SM58s. So big thanks to you, Christian, for lending me another microphone. So if you're enjoying the podcast, do please help me out so you can give me a good review on iTunes or even a bad review. Anything helps, you know. But also, if you want to contribute financially, which I would be ever so grateful for, you can go to Patreon, and if you search Improvise Music Agenda in Patreon, you can find me there. And I've got some cool prizes. Well, sort of prizes. If you subscribe, you get a CD of the Hon album I did a few years back. And yeah, I'm going to try and put up a little feed of kind of exclusive stuff to the podcast and maybe some stuff I didn't use. So there's another 15 minutes of this interview, which is exclusive listenership kind of thing. So yeah, please check out the Patreon and donate. Also, Happy to say, I've been on another podcast recently, which is cool. So I went on Rob Cope's jazz podcast. So, yeah, you could find that somewhere if you just look up in iTunes. But I'm guessing some of you might know, since it's the other British podcast talking to musicians. Although, I'd like to sort of give a warning. So, Rob is more careful than I am and edits out all the swearing. Fuck's sake. But, so, I think I have a tendency sometimes to kind of swear positively. If he was asking about something, you know, if I say something like, yeah, fucking badass, cool, yeah, you know, that kind of general language that makes me sound like an idiot. But there's one bit when I talk about the formative years in that podcast about James Madron coming to stay with me and Lloyd Haynes when we were in college, and he beeped it out, so it made it sound like I was having a go at him, which I definitely wasn't. So, just to clear that up, in case that sounds weird, and if you listen to that podcast, I put disclaimer here. But anyway, but do please check out Rob's podcast, and on the day we recorded his, he recorded one for me, so that's going to be coming up at some point in the future. Just want to find time to edit everything together. Anyway, so, less about me and my things. Here's the conversation with Jonathan Lindhorst.
You know, Berlin tends to be gray from like September till, you know, late February normally. So it's nice to get some sun out. There was like a couple of months there where it was just gray and dark every day, all day.
Yeah, totally. Man, I felt a bit self-conscious walking around with my sunglasses. I thought this is like totally not the vibe, February in Berlin.
Well, I don't know, when the sun's out.
That's true, yeah. It's one of those rare occasions.
Don't let anyone change you, Hugh. You do you.
Exactly.
I know you like your sunglasses.
Yeah, man. Good, good. Man, so how long have you been in Berlin now then? It's like,
I have been here 5 years. I actually had the 5-year anniversary when I stepped off the plane January 13th. So, yeah, 5 years now.
Good. Yeah, man. But to rewind a bit. So where did you grow up? In Toronto, in the suburbs?
I grew up outside of Toronto. It's a city called Mississauga. It's in Ontario. It's like 40 minutes outside of Toronto. It's the suburbs, but it's a big city in its own way. I mean, it's like actually the fourth largest city in Canada, but it's mostly just houses. We have a really, really big mall.
Good.
We have one of the largest malls in North America.
Amazing.
Square One. And it gets bigger every time I go back.
Oh, really?
Over. Yeah, they've started developing the parking lot. It's crazy.
Good, good. And then, yeah, so how far was that from Toronto? So I'm guessing that a lot of music was
Toronto, right? 40 minutes. Yeah, there's not much of a creative scene in Mississauga. I mean, there's, you know, there's some people who do that stuff, but Toronto is really the place. I mean, when you live so close, and Toronto is, I mean, one of the cultural capitals of Canada. I mean, you know, that and Montreal and Vancouver as well, to, you know, to an extent. But Toronto is a place where the bands that tend to get out of Canada sort of congregate, especially in the, you know, the jazz scene is not as much so for that, but definitely in the rock, pop, folk country scene, there's you know, a lot of a number of friends of mine, you know, they play in like rock bands, and they start out in jazz and they kind of went into that vein, and they tour constantly. They go all over Europe and they play big shows. And
sure, yeah, because who's it, like Arcade Fire, aren't they based like Montreal or something?
I don't know where they're based out of now. I don't know where they live these days, but they started in Montreal. And actually, like, when I was at McGill, my first year of McGill, I forget the names of the people in that band. The main guy, he was, I believe, studying philosophy at McGill at the time, and the girl, the main singer, the female singer in that band, she was in the jazz program. She was doing a vocal jazz thing, and she was like kind of in her last year when I started.
All right, cool.
So and all the people that I went to school with who were like a few years older than me, you know, like 3-4 years older, that generation of people, they were involved in that band in the early incarnations. Like, friends of mine are on Funeral and they're on Neon Bible, and they did the touring stuff, like cello players, string players, horn players, you know, people like that.
Oh, hip. Cool. And then, but rewinding back to the Toronto thing. So, yeah, what were the first jazz shows you were seeing there? Like, was it...
Well, Toronto, when I mean, Toronto was a very good place for jazz, actually, growing up. So I started playing when I was around 10 years old, like 93. So that's showing my age. And the 90s were a very, very different time for music overall. I mean, the industry was very different. Things changed a lot. I sort of really felt it in 2003 when technology kind of started changing the gig landscape a lot. But I was very fortunate to come up at that time because there was a lot of work. There was a lot of gigs, and I was gigging constantly all throughout high school. Like tons of restaurants and weddings and cafes and whatever. I played at least 4 to 6 shows a month. And I was making, you know, I was making almost $600 a month playing gigs when I was like 15, which was, you know, big money when you're 15 living with your parents. I put it all into buying records and stuff.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
and at the time there were two major clubs that were amazing. There was this place called the Top of the Senator and another place called the Montreal Bistro, and they functioned like jazz clubs did like back in the old days, where you know, a band would come in and play for like a whole week.
Right, yeah.
And you know, that's just something you don't really see very often anymore. I mean, like, you know, the Bad Plus or whoever will do the Vanguard for a week, but
yeah,
you know, it, generally speaking, that model out of the biggest clubs like New York and whatever doesn't really happen. But so when I was growing up, like you know, you could be, you know, the generation of guys who were very active in the scene playing at the time, you know, like my former teacher, Mike Murley, who's a great saxophone player, and all the guys who basically are on faculty at like University of Toronto and New York University and Humber College, they would have their projects and they would play for like an entire week. So you could go out any night of the week and see really great music, and they would bring in, legendary figures.
I mean, like the local guys would be there. So it's not just like
it wasn't just names. I'd say like once every 4 to 6 weeks, there would be a week where at one of these places where like a name would come in and have a week.
Oh, okay.
So like I got to see Ray Brown.
Yeah, man.
I got to see Kenny Barron. I got to see George Coleman. What else? I saw John Abercrombie. I saw Jack DeJohnette. I, you know, play piano at one of these clubs. It was really incredible. And it's like, there's still a lot of cool things happening in Toronto. I think creatively, Toronto, maybe on a local level, became a more interesting place. I mean, that's maybe just my thing. I mean, it was very much like a conservative, straight ahead jazz town when I was growing up. And then when I go back and I visit and I see what the guys my age are doing, and especially what some of the, there's this whole new crop of people in their 20s who are all doing very cool, interesting, creative things and performing them, you know, in little rooms for the Hat and the Door. And, you know, it's like, you know, $50 gigs. You know, but back then it was like the money was better. The union had more power, I guess. I mean, it's all a little before my time. And there was, concerts, you know, we had some big concert halls, like Roy Thompson Hall, Massey Hall, places like that. I saw some crazy bands. I saw, first concert I went to with my dad, one jazz concert I can remember going to, is I saw the Count Basie Orchestra with, Joe Williams.
Nice.
And then like a month later I saw Sonny Rollins play trio, and that was like, you know, that was like a big moment for me. I'd been playing saxophone for like 6 months and I saw Sonny Rollins. I was like, well this is obviously what I'm going to do.
Yeah, that must be life changing. Just like fucking Sonny Rollins.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I'm very grateful that I got to see those people live and in clubs. I saw Joe Henderson.
Oh, wow.
I saw Joe Henderson play trio with Charlie Hayden and Al Foster.
Oh, yeah, because they did a record, didn't they?
They did a bunch of records. And, hey, Murray. How are you doing? For the listening audience, my girlfriend has just come home. I saw Joshua Redman play all the time. Like, one of my favorite bands in high school was Joshua Redman's 90s quartet with Mel Dow, Christian McBride, and Brian Blade.
I saw
that band play so many times. Every time they came through town, I would go see them. I was such, like, Joshua Redman was like, for contemporary saxophone, was like my hero when I was in high school. Totally.
Yeah, you man. Know? Oh, man. That sounds great, though. So much music
around.
Because I guess with the touring thing back then,
there was way more opportunities and money. And also, this was the 90s, so it was like the Young Lion era. Like,
right.
Blue Note kind of came back, and they were, there was an, you know, Wynton Marsalis led that resurgence and that you know, there was this new interest pop in jazz. Jazz was like kind of popular again in the 90s. Especially for a certain kind of jazz that was some more of like a throwback to the older school, obviously, and a big emphasis on African American musicians. They were really trying to recapture that cultural connection to the music at the time. So there was a lot going on, and I got to play all the time, and I went to workshops all the time, and there was a music store called Long McQuaid still there, and they would have, like, you know, masterclass workshops pretty regularly, and with really good people. And so where I saw, I got to play and meet Jimmy Heath at one of those. And I, that was a big moment. And I also got to, you know, and I met Ingrid Jensen that way. A lot of, you know, famous Canadian musicians who had come through town. And it was a very good learning. It was a great place to be. And there was so many great young musicians and people that, you know, I was playing, a lot of the people that I was playing with in high school, like they're still playing, they're still doing it, you know, and some of them are doing bigger things than other people, but most of them are still active and you know, out there, which is great.
Oh man, that sounds mega. Yeah, sounds like a place to be. I mean, that must have been great with the formative years. I guess, yeah, like, you know, if there's so much music happening at a young age, I must...
Yeah, and
make
I was
the path for them.
And I was super lucky. My parents were supportive. They were always very like, don't put all your eggs in one basket. And I don't think they really wanted me to go be a professional musician for money reasons. But I got to say, at the end of the day, like, they took me to a lot of concerts. I grew up listening to tons of music. My dad has 8,000 records, so I...
8,000 records.
Oh yeah, man, the basement is insane. There's music was just kind of always around, and they'd take me to lots of concerts. They'd be out late and take me to shows, and you know, so man, what else did I see? I saw Rene Rosnes when I was like 14 play with Chris Potter.
Oh yeah.
Before he was famous. Basically, it was amazing. You know, no one knew who he was, and I was like, what is this? am I hearing right now?
Oh, cool. So your parents were into music before you got into the saxophone, or was it like
my dad's into music, but he's also, I would say he's more into record collecting than he is into music, but he loves music, but he's really, his big thing was like 50s rock and roll.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Like, And he would make all these like compilation cassette tapes. He had hundreds of them, and that was mostly what we were listening to. And he was very like, you know, we didn't really get a say in what was being played. I mean, he was, you know, so it was a mixture of like jazz, a certain kind of jazz. Like, you know, my parents like it when it's pretty and mellow.
Right.
So
yeah,
it was,
well, Paul Desmond records and
Paul
like that,
Desmond, I mean. But a lot of Stan Getz.
Oh yeah.
A lot of like Ben Webster and Coleman Hawkins and Lester Young. That era, Louis Armstrong, Oscar Peterson. That kind of thing. Coltrane was not cool.
No.
there was a like, my dad did not like Coltrane. It was a big deal for me when I went out and bought a Coltrane record and put it on. And I think the first, I mean, I heard a Coltrane recording when I was, within like 6 months of my playing that changed my life, that really made me like decide to do this, was Coltrane playing Greensleeves.
Oh yeah, is that stuff?
African Brass.
Yeah, sessions. Yeah. Is that the one where he plays it on Soprano?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's and I heard that on the radio. I would like listen. I had a Walkman, which for the kids in the audience was like a cassette thing with a radio that you could, a portable cassette player with a radio that you could record the radio onto your cassette. And so I would listen to this radio show every night called The Jazz Scene with Ted O'Reilly, and I would it was on every night from 10 to 1, and I'd listen to the whole program, and I'd tape it, and then I'd go to school and listen to the broadcasts over and over again. I had all my cassettes, and I was pretty much just continuously listening to music and ignoring my teachers, and yes. I just be in class with my head down with my headphones on and try to like,
oh well, like just trying to sneak in, listen,
yeah,
to
just kind of walk around with them on. And yeah, so I was, but when I heard the Coltrane, the Greensleeves thing, you know, I thought like jazz sounded cool, but I didn't, you know, obviously I didn't understand what I was listening to or what was happening and so on. But when I heard Greensleeves and it was like this recognizable melody, it was like a song I knew, it was this Christmas carol, I suddenly got it. I suddenly understood that that was the power that jazz had, where you could take a song and transform it into this powerful new experience with a different kind of energy. So that's that. Then, and I remember I told my mom after hearing that, you know, I was like, I'm going to be as good as John Coltrane, which I have not done yet.
But
I have a few more years.
But I mean, like, even those records, the way he sounds in Soprano, or even the way it sounds anyway, but like, you know, it's like so open. It feels like,
yeah, man,
the heavens shining through.
Fearless.
You know? I mean, I don't know. It's got some amazing quality, some of that music.
Yeah.
You know, and like, because I remember one of that summer school that you made that list.
Oh, yeah, at Jim's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it was on their Sonship.
Sonship's one of my favorite ones. Actually, like, I had a teacher at McGill, saxophone player Frank Lozano, and he told me, if you listen to Sonship first thing in the morning every day for a month, like, as soon as you get up, like, the first thing you do is just turn on Sonship, it will change your life.
Man, I remember you gave me the instruction as well.
Yeah, and I made it 3 weeks into it before my girlfriend at the time said, no, you're not allowed to do this anymore. So, but it's powerful, man. It's from the first note, it's just, you know, buddy up, buddy up, buddy up.
Mate, yeah, it's the best. Yeah. Yeah,
Sonship.
But yeah, but I mean, that music though, because it's all improvised, that record, because I can't quite figure out, because
I don't know if it is, sounds
sort of organized and composed.
Well, there's like I think it's like on the second track, they have like a bit of talking at the beginning where Coltrane's kind of giving them instructions, and he says something along the lines of like, yeah, so then you go into that thing, and then you just kind of keep the thing for a while, and they're like, okay. And it's I don't know. I mean, I haven't really checked it out. I don't believe it's totally free. I think there's a lot of free stuff going on.
Yeah.
But If you've seen some of the, like, have you ever seen the score for A Love Supreme?
Yeah, I think there was a thing going on Facebook.
Yeah, like one, just, you know, it's like one sheet, one long sheet of staff paper with just like kind of scrawling out, you know, certain melodic motifs.
Yeah.
And then directions and like how to do it. It's almost like a contemporary classical score.
Yeah, totally.
So there's melodic themes, and then there's a lot of freedom, and the thing is, like, that last movement there, I mean, there's a poem, right? Like, for the last movement, and his solo, if you listen to it, what he plays is the poem.
Oh, right.
Yeah, there's this documentary on Coltrane. I have like a radio documentary where it was listened to, and they were talking about that. And I didn't realize it. And a singer recorded himself like singing along with the solo to the words of the poem, and it lines up exactly.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. You know, it's... Yeah, I mean, I think Coltrane's very structured, you know.
Definitely.
Actually.
Yeah, because, you know, John O'Gallagher, you know, alto player, American guy, because he's doing a PhD in Birmingham, in the UK.
Mm.
But I think he's doing it on Coltrane.
Mm.
I remember him mentioning, because what was it? Because I was lending my bass to Michael Bates. And I think they're friends and stuff.
Yeah,
it was just like kind of hearing them talking about the Coltrane's method. So he's like, you know, that tri-chord thing.
You mean like the tritonic series? Like the thing that they're basing...
Yeah, so it's like tone rows and stuff.
Was this like the giant steps?
Yeah, sort of. But I think it's like a bit deeper than that again later on. But anyway, I think it's like... Because to me, it sort of makes sense, you know, kind of the way he organizes pitches and stuff, especially with Sonship, you know, the first track.
Yeah.
Which is called Sonship, right? But anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it sounds a bit like that. But then I remember him saying with, I think one of the solos, one of the tracks of Love Supreme, where it's like a kind of, it's like a tone clock or something, where he'd start in like F minor or whatever. Then he jumped to B flat minor, then back to F minor, then to
other end. I have seen copies of notes from his notebooks where they have the circle of fifths and then all the related harmonic points, and there's just lines connecting everything. It looks like something out of a zodiac sign. And yeah, I've never been that into the math of the thing to really totally... I've been studying it more lately. I was kind of like sort of anti-theory, anti-harmony a lot in high school and my undergrad too, because I had this naive sort of idea of being a naturalistic player, and I was really into the myth of the old guys, and you just feel the music, and you know, I had some mentors at the time who kind of talked that way. But in the last, you know, over the last decade, I've got deeper into understanding harmony, and so especially in the last couple of years, I got really a lot deeper into understanding harmony, and I've it just makes things so much richer now that I have a better understanding of it.
Yeah.
But when I see that, it's like, I look at it, I go, whoa, and I don't totally get it.
Totally. But I was like starting to read these books about, like the Zorn books, Arcana.
I've perused them. I haven't, that's the one with the collection of essays, right?
That's right. Yeah. But
I think I read the one by Dave Douglas, and I read one by, Trevor Dunn, I think, and I read...
Oh, yeah, that's...
What's his name? I'm getting older, I forget names. Singer. Faith No More guy.
Oh, Mike Patton.
Mike Patton. Yeah, Mike Patton, I think, wrote an interesting one.
All right, cool, yeah, because... which one am I thinking of? But yeah, like, there were some essays about, like, microtonality and how they work with harmony. Like, what's his name? Steve Lehman.
Yeah.
You know, with how spectral music sort of constructed from all that, and it's just like all crazy.
Yeah. I've been getting more and more into Steve Lehman's music over the last couple of years, and I haven't yet to really understand how he's thinking. I haven't really checked out the harmony of how he's thinking.
Yeah.
The first thing I hear is actually rhythm.
Yeah, no, totally. I think it's coming from that. But then, yeah, but all that kind of microtonality thing,
yeah,
that approach to harmony, I mean, that's like, yeah, all scary.
Yeah, there's some guys, I mean, there's a saxophone, do you know Hayden Chisholm? You ever heard of this guy? He's in Route 60.
Was he living in Cologne or Munich?
I don't know where he is now, actually.
But
he was here at some point. But he's got this ability to play like microtonal shit on the saxophone. He can like do, you know, he knows all this crazy fingerings, and he can play solos that just kind of go between all these quarter tones and stuff. I know a couple of guys who work on that. I experiment with it as a textural thing, but I haven't worked out like a system.
Yeah, no, totally, man. It's funny with all that stuff, because I guess it exists in like a lot of Eastern music. But I remember playing with a oud player.
Yeah, big time Eastern music.
Yeah, he was showing me like these, like what they call the makams, you know, the scales stuff. And then, I remember used to get like totally wound up when like on the piano they'd be playing octaves. They used to like really fuck up his ears. And he'd be like, yeah, I don't play tonal music. It was like, yeah, man, deep.
Yeah.
But it's mental, like, because it sort of makes sense, but it's sort of ingrained in your ear not to... like the Western thing, you know, like, it's tough to kind of do it in a way.
Yeah.
Because, you know, your ear just sort of gravitates towards the equal temperament.
Well, it's what we're used to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this stuff is very much based around culture.
Yeah, for definite, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I find it hard enough to just learn how to hear everything in Western with just 12 notes.
Man,
if we suddenly had to deal with like 64 notes or something, yeah, I'd be totally. Like,
Man, I bet if Coltrane was still alive, he would have done his like octatones records or whatever.
Well, he was, I mean, I'm not a Coltrane expert at all, but my understanding is he was checking that out, especially towards the end. I think he was, in the 60s, I think he was quite into like Indian music and African music and...
Oh yeah,
I think he was checking it out for sure.
Yeah. Oh man.
You can only speculate like where he would have gone.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
after he left us.
Definitely.
But yeah.
Yeah, man. So with McGill. So you're a big Coltrane guy. Well, you were still in McGill, or were you?
I was
a bunch of other tenor players.
I mean, I love Coltrane, and I've definitely spent time with Coltrane's music, but I would never describe myself as, like, a Coltrane head. Like, I went to school with people who were, like, Coltrane heads.
Right, yeah.
There's a really great saxophonist in Montreal named Al McLean who can, like really do the Coltrane thing, like, to a level that I would never even come close. Like, I think he played at his master's, for one of his master's exams. I heard a story, like, he played some 20-minute Coltrane transcription from memory or something. And, like, he, you know, I mean, and I had some other friends that I was with at the time who were just obsessed with Coltrane. But actually, my biggest influence when I was growing up was Stan Getz.
All right, okay.
Because it was the sound and the melodicism and how beautiful it was. And I guess, like, you know... I don't know. I guess I sort of started out in a very conservative place, and I'm constantly trying to push my own boundaries and expose. I mean, I do have this tendency where I see or hear something and it makes me go like, I don't know about this. Yeah. But I always force myself. I can usually tell when there's something to it, and I force myself to check it out just to try, and because I want to understand what's going on, and oftentimes those become like my favorite records. And you know it's like my own development. I mean, I'm always trying to go be broad and try different things, and I maintain this love of older, more traditional jazz to this day. Is something I listen to a lot, and especially stuff from the swing era. Like, I think these days, you know, like, I'm more likely to listen to Lester Young than John Coltrane, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, like, when I was starting out, I mean, it was also a function of, like, conceptually how I perceived myself as a musician, because it was much more of, like, a trade, I think, when I was coming up. And it was sort of taught that way, and it wasn't about as much about... creative expression and finding your own voice and doing something really different. It was more about like learning the tunes, learning how to play over the tunes and going out and getting the gigs, you know, and that was sort of the vibe for a lot of people, at least in Toronto at the time. And, you know, definitely for me, like, you know, I wasn't playing like concerts. I wasn't playing like creative concerts all the time. I didn't actually start doing that until, kind of the end of high school, but even then they were sort of happening like cafes and stuff, and you had to be aware that like the audience was not there for that. So yeah, I mean, it was just about learning a lot of standards and playing, you know, in a way that was sort of palatable, that could get you gigs. And like, and it worked for me because I loved Stan Getz and I tried to copy him and emulate him. I also really loved Ben Webster, and I mean, I checked out everyone, you know, Sonny Rollins and Joe Henderson, Wayne, and you know, all those big guys, Charlie Parker, obviously too, and you know, it was you know, I loved ballads. I always have loved playing ballads. I loved it more than playing fast stuff.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you know, starting out from there, and now I mean, like, you know, the other week I was playing at an art gallery in a electronic drone duo, you know, working with like microtonal pitches and long held notes forever. And,
cool.
You know, I've gotten more into like extended, a lot of free improvisation and extended techniques on saxophone, like, you know, taking the mouthpiece off and making elephant sounds and
yeah, man.
Whatever, but, you know.
So did all that start to come together when you were in Montreal?
Actually, that didn't enter my head until we met at gyms.
All right, so is that, that week that you started getting into
that was
the more open stuff?
Well, before that, I'd started in a sense like I had done some free improvising in sessions, and had even done one improv concert. But I think like my first main creative project was this band called, well, outside of school. There were things in school, but outside of school, my first project was this trio called Turtle Boy, which was a bassless trio, sax, guitar, drums. And we were very influenced by the music of Paul Motion. And that trio with Bill Frisell and Lovano was a big thing for us. And actually, the guitar player and I like went down to New York and spent a week there. We went to the Vanguard like four nights in a row to see that band play. Oh, and it was like amazing, a very big moment for us. So we would have like kind of a motion-y approach to free improvisation in that music. It's what, especially the music in the first record that we did. And I was writing, I had started writing music that was just kind of like melodies with no chords, and then we just go, and it would be this textural, vibey, open improv thing that we were sort of going for at the time. And then as I, you know, we developed and we got into like Jim Black, and we got into the Bad Plus, and we got into, you know, the more contemporary things, and that started changing the music that band was into, until like, you know, the third record was almost like an indie rock record basically.
But
it wasn't until we went to gyms where I saw like the full extent of what you could do. It really blew me away,
man. That changed my life that week, because
yeah,
I think is that week was when I had my 18th birthday.
I thought you were 16.
No, I think it was just after I finished school, just before college.
Man. Wow.
And then...
Such a chicken.
Yeah. But I remember, like, I think you were the only one who understood me, because I had such a thick Welsh accent. But what I found crazy with that week was seeing people playing free, playing little sessions in between, like, the classes.
Yeah.
And seeing, like, Mark Dresser...
Yeah.
...doing his, like, petrifying thing, and then Jim Black being all that...
Yeah, and also, like, we played, like, we did Cobra, I think. I participated in some Cobra sessions, it was the first time I realized that, like, free improvisation wasn't just a whatever free-for-all. There was things to practice and ideas and concepts and structures, and there was a way of composing within that music, and that really was the beginning for me to open my ears in this whole new direction. And then around that time, a friend of mine, who's a tremendous flautist and saxophonist in Brooklyn now, Anna Weber, who I was doing school with at the time, we had a hang at my place, and there was, like, you know, this is before streaming music, and it wasn't so easy to know about, like, what was going on in New York, and it's a lot of those, like, newer records weren't getting, like, much distribution in Canada. Like, you couldn't go to an HMV and go to the jazz section and find, like, a Tim Byrne section, you know, that, like, that music wasn't kind of around. But there was this group of guys that had a scene at McGill, and Anna was one of them, who were really, really into, like, the contemporary new New York shit. And she did me one of the greatest favors of my life and came over and just played me all this stuff. And that's when I heard records that have become, like, my favorite records. Like,
all right.
That's when I first heard The Vastness of Space. And that's, my favorite record. Probably one of my all-time favorite records.
Man, yeah.
You know,
Reed Anderson's such a genius.
Yeah, it's the first time I heard Reed. It's the first time I heard Bill McHenry, who I went on to study with, and Tony Malaby, who I also studied with a bit, and Chris Speed and Andrew D'Angelo and Tim Byrne and, you know, all these guys that, you know, when I moved to New York some years later, were the people that I would go see all the time. That was what I was there to see and check out. And, you know, I mean, I'd go see Mark Turner and Chris Potter and whatever, they're great. But for me, that Brooklyn contemporary composed, improvised, rocky thing was just, that was the sound. I mean, the first trip I ever made to New York, by myself, like as an adult, to get a lesson with Bill, I went to this place that's not there anymore, but it was a great spot called the Tea Lounge.
I think I've heard of that. Yeah,
yeah, man, it was a cool spot. I would hang out there all the time in Park Slope, and they had a session that was run by John McNeil, who was a bit of, you know, one of my sort of local mentors in a way. I would go and talk to him whenever I could.
Yeah, is he the trumpet player?
Yeah, yeah.
There's those records with him and Bill McHenry.
Yeah, they have a quartet together, and Bill, John is one of Bill's mentors, actually.
All right.
And John kind of is the figurehead of this scene in Brooklyn that I guess I would, it's like kind of like a post-50s cool revival kind of thing.
Right, yeah.
There's this whole scene built around John McNeil.
Amazing.
So it's like that kind of music, but with a twist, I guess is the way,
yeah,
how I would describe it.
Yeah, I've heard snippets of that band. It sounds really cool. It's kind of...
Yeah, yeah. John also plays in a really great band called Hush Point. Hush Point? Hush Puppy. Hush Point, I think is what it's called.
All right.
That he does with a saxophonist named Jeremy Udin, who's a fantastic player and a beautiful composer. And a friend of mine that I went to McGill with as well, this bass player, Aria Kubrinsky. And I forget who's on drums, actually, but I think they changed drummers. I'm not sure. But they have a couple of records out that are awesome.
Oh, cool, yeah.
And... but anyway, I'm off topic. I meander.
That's good, man.
But yeah, so I remember, you know, I was in Fort Greene and I went to Bill's place for the lesson. And it was this ass kicker of a lesson. And then I wandered down into Park Slope and met up with some people at this show. And it was the Andrew D'Angelo Trio with Jim and Trevor Dunn.
Oh, yeah. Well, what's that band called? Gay Disco.
The Gay Disco Trio.
I think so.
And they played Gay Disco. And it just, I was just like, holy shit. This is like, I'm here, I'm in New York, and I just paid $5 to see, like, these musicians that I totally admire and idolize, and, like, in a place with, like, couches and stuff, and it's so different than this, like, fancy smancy jazz club vibe, and it's gritty, and it was a hang, and the room was packed, and it was packed full of, it was this weird cross-section of people from different times in my life. There were people in the room that I knew from McGill. There were people in the room that I knew from Toronto. There were people in the room that I met at gyms and I knew from Europe. There were people that I'd met at the Banff Center, where I'd done the program there the previous summer. And it was just like, fuck, everyone's here. Yeah. I was just like, these are my folks. These are my people. I was just like, from that moment on, I was like, fuck shopping gigs. Fuck, I don't want to be the guy who plays weddings. I don't want to be I'm sick of these, like, restaurant, whatever gigs just to make a bit of cash. And I saw in this one room just this cross section of my generation of creative musicians, and everyone went in there was someone that I deeply respected and admired as musicians, and I was like, well, man, I want to be one of these folks. This is where I want. And that's when I pretty much decided I had to move to New York. It was like one visit. I was like,
yeah, man.
I started packing my shit, you know.
But so. Yeah, man, that's the vibe, isn't it? It's kind of,
yeah,
yeah. But cool. So yeah. So when was that? You moved to New York, was it?
I showed up
after McGill.
Oh yeah, man, it was some years. I finished McGill properly, like did my final exam in like 2006, and then I moved to New York in 2010.
Oh, okay.
So I had 4 years of kicking around Montreal in between.
Cool. And then, yeah. So what was the big thing when you first moved to New York then? Was it, so you went to check out loads of shows or?
First thing was to get an apartment, man. I got screwed over on housing the second I got there. My brother drove me down and we parked the car, and like the apartment had fallen through. I found out like 2 days earlier, and I was like, I showed up with all my stuff and we stashed it at this friend of mine who, like, after that was just like, it was just way too much of an imposition. Like, I didn't hang out with her much after that. Yeah, and then I was homeless for, like, the better part of the first month, and, like, our parents' car got towed on the first day. New York was just, you know, it's like, I had this rosy kind of, like, you know, I had a grant, and I showed up and went for a lesson and went to some cool concerts and making these visits, and they're, like, fun and great and whatever. And then, like, as soon as I tried to move there for real, the city was like, ha, psych, fuck you, motherfucker. This is the hardest shit that will ever happen to you. I got mugged in the first week.
Oh, man.
It's like some guy stole $20 off of me. And like, yeah, and it was just, it was, it, and then I ended up staying in this weird, and the apartments I saw were like so weird. There was this one thing I saw on the Upper East Side. It was this like 40-50-year-old drummer who had just been there forever, and like I walked into this shady apartment, and like there was like, you walk in, there was like, you know, this narrow thing and a couch, and then there's like the one bedroom, and then, you know, I walk in the kitchen, it was all half built, and there was like a hose running from the sink going into the bathroom into the tub. Because there was no plumbing under the sink.
Shit,
and you had to like connect one hose to a different hose to get the shower to work. And then I was kind of like, okay, but there's only one bedroom and one bed. Like, where do you sleep? And he showed me, and I didn't see this at first, but like this narrow living room that I walked through to get to the bedroom. Actually, there was like, I noticed that what I thought was a bookcase was actually just wallpaper. And it was like, he built a little wall and created like a crawl space for himself behind this wall. And it was just like a mattress shoved back there. Oh, and that's how this dude was living. And I was like, this is
man,
fucked.
He didn't live there, did he?
No, I didn't live there. I ended up in this really weird gentrified place in Bushwick. It was like it was built as like an artist condo situation, but it was just like, it was weird. It was hipsters with money just ruining the neighborhood more or less. But yeah. And it was like kind of like a modern building and whatever. And they had these units that were obviously built for like families or two people. But for some of them, they had done a thing where they like built an extra wall in the living room to create a third room. But so I took this shitty small little room. But what it was, the whole front of the of this building was glass.
All right.
So I just had a, I was there, it was like a drywall, little wall for a tiny room that was not even as big as this kitchen, and then a wall of glass.
Oh man,
that so would like, you would have to spend so much money to get drapes that could hang on this giant wall of glass. Oh, so for the first 4 months, I lived like, I had like a mattress and a little desk, and I did not get along with my roommates, and no privacy. I was just like, you know, people across the building across from me could see me getting undressed and going to sleep. And, you know, 7 a.m., the sun would come in and wake me up.
Because I guess, you kind of slept much.
It was, and everything. I did 4 months of that place. And then I found a great spot.
Okay,
that's
cool.
In Bed-Stuy, and I was there for the rest of the time.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. And then, so were you doing a lot on the scene there? Because you were involved with iBeam.
I was the booker and space manager for iBeam for, I guess, a year and a half or so. Brian Dry, the guy who sort of coordinates the space, needed someone to help out. And I got a couple hundred bucks a month to basically answer the emails and organize who got the room when and whatever. And, you know, and I'd have to go and sweep up, and obviously, and I had access to this space if I wanted to have like a rehearsal or a practice session or something, but I could do that at home. So I didn't use it that way too often. But I got, you know, I'd work the door at these shows, and, you know, and great people would play there, like Jim or Malaby or whomever, and Tim Byrne, and I'd just be the guy making sure they had drinks and putting the chairs away at the end of the night, you know. But it was a fantastic opportunity to kind of be around, you know, and take stuff in.
Yeah, totally, because I guess there's a lot of power.
Yeah.
Not a lot of power, but, you know, kind of, yeah, you can kind of take advantage of being around a lot of musicians if you're running a venue, I suppose.
And in terms of musicians I was playing with, that group Turtle Boy that I mentioned earlier, all the guys in that band ended up moving to New York too around that time. So that band kept going, and that was the time. And that time we were rehearsing and playing like all the time. We were playing in a restaurant every week, and we were working on, you know, we did some tours, and we recorded a couple of albums during that period. So a lot of the time was spent playing with that band and developing that band. And I formed some great friendships and connections. Like, to this day, I have a very, good friendship with this amazing Swiss pianist, Sebastian Amon.
All right.
Who's still there 10 years later, basically, living in Brooklyn, doing his thing. And he's actually coming over here. He's playing at the Sideways series in a month.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's with his new band, Color Wheel.
Is that Michael Atias?
Michael Atias, Noah Garabedian, and Nathan Elman Bell, and Samuel Blazer is going to be a special guest on that one.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm very excited for that show, and it's a great record. It's available on Skrull Records, Color Wheels.
Oh, great. So you got the series happening now. So Sideways. So that's in Berlin.
That's in Berlin.
Yes. We'll get back to New York in a second, but... great. So you co-run that with
I co-run that with my friend Mags Briggs, and it's been going on for, this is I think the fifth season that we're in now.
Oh wow.
So 2 years. And she started it. She's been running it officially by herself up until last season, when she sort of, I would help out, and I would, you know, play at it. And then sometimes she'd ask me questions or for advice on, you know, what do you think of this band? What do you think of that band? Cause she's sort of coming from a place where, her background is actually more in like bluegrass music and things like that. So she was sort of learning about jazz on the fly a little bit.
Okay.
Then last season she invited me officially to sort of share the work with her, and it's been great. So like last season was very successful, and we got much more, we became a lot more selective about the booking and tried to curate a whole season at once with like a broader view of like how it all kind of fits together and not just stay, you know, focused on one little scene, often happens with these kinds of things. You know, we really wanted to bring in people who operate in different, like a more diverse selection of Berlin groups, but also bring in some international groups as well, obviously with like Sebastian's band. We didn't want to have it all just be like just avant-garde improv or just straight ahead or whatever, you know. And also people, you know, we'd have people who were kind of, you know, younger and recently, you know, maybe they just graduated from the JIB recently but we also brought in like more established, you know, Berlin people that, you know, weren't necessarily going to ask us for a gig. So we approached them and said, you know, would you be willing to do this? We have a good relationship with our host venue, which is the Café du Jardin. We try really hard to make it a good experience, you know. So we set up the room like a proper concert situation, and we make sure that the audience knows that that's the vibe, so you don't get people like ordering, you know, like talking through the show or, you know, drinking and doing shots and whatever, you know. It's a concert, you know.
Yeah, that's important because, it doesn't happen so much in London anymore. You know, like all these like kind of people doing their little series kind of thing.
Well, it's tough, you know, and this is one of the reasons we're fortunate because, like, you know, I've tried to run some series in the past that didn't go very far because, you know, the relationship that you have with the venue, unless you own your own venue, run your own space, which is, you know, not our situation at the moment, but if you and the people you're working with aren't on the same page about what it's supposed to be, and if, you know, what sometimes happens is like a venue will value the money over the art, and that's understandable because people have their bottom lines and whatever, but
yeah, exactly,
you know,
but, yeah,
and then it becomes, well, we need more singers or we need more laid back kind of music, and we want people to feel like they can chat and be at home and order more drinks, and I understand those are compromises that, you know, if you're running a venue, sometimes you have to make those compromises to keep the doors open. But we've been very fortunate that we can have this opportunity to present, you know, world-class music in a nice, cozy space that, it, you know, I mean, it's like, of course, it's cool to go see, you know, music in a punked out little underground spot, but it's actually kind of nice that it's a nice room and there's wine and you can get food and you know, it's a comfortable, cool place to be, which allows us to attract in a broader range of people. Actually, you know, we get a lot of young people, but we also get a lot of older people and people who are willing to spend more money on food and drinks too. So that helps the club, I think.
And
it's been a phenomenal experience. It's been an incredible experience doing this and being on this side of the table, you know, like as a musician, you're always sending out emails and you're looking for opportunities and gigs and chances to play and so on. And you're not even, I find very often you're not even sure like how they're thinking about it, you know, like what their criteria is like as a booker or a club manager or whatever. And it's been really crazy for me to like be the guy to sort through the emails and think about this in broader sense. And it gives me some insight into like how I guess a lot of these other places probably operate too.
Yeah, totally. 'Cause a friend of mine was saying kind of, how it helped him run some gigs, because getting his stuff together when he wants to ask another promoter.
Yeah, yeah.
And like what they need, but you know, kind of. But also, it's a good thing for the community as well around. And
that's,
you know,
that's a big thing for me. You know, one thing that I feel kind of happens in Berlin sometimes is it's a big place and there's a lot of stuff happening, and there's these little microcosm scenes that are littered around the city where people don't really necessarily know each other or know about each other's music and so on. And it's, you know, and I work pretty hard to sort of have a broad understanding of who's around and who's playing and what kind of things they're doing. I try my best to stay on top of that. And, you know, I want to create, we wanted to create a space where we could bring people from these different communities sort of together.
Yeah.
Under one place, you know?
Yeah, that's great, man. So, the move from Brooklyn to Berlin. So, how was that transition? I guess it would have been, less stressful here.
Well, yeah. I mean, New York was, you know, I went as a student and I had my student loans, and it was a intense experience. It was an intense learning. It was a fantastic learning experience. You know, there's just, you know, you can't really beat New York in terms of the ability to see your heroes play any night of the week. But, you know, I mean, it's expensive, you know, and it's difficult to be there. It's difficult to stay there, especially if you're not an American. There's a whole immigration thing to deal with. And my last year there, when I wasn't in school and I found myself working 60 hours a week and still not making really enough money, you know, like I was walking dogs. I was working in a cafe. I was doing the iBeam thing as well, and it was a very intense, an exhausting experience. And I had never moved to New York with the idea that I was going to stay there. Right. I had come to Berlin after the gym's workshop and kind of fallen in love with the city. And it was always, and I have German roots, you know, my father is German. So I kind of grew up with this German thing in my family. I guess it just appealed to me to live in Germany and connect with this part of my, I don't know, heritage or whatever. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it got to that point in New York where if I was going to stay, I'd have to start investing a lot of time and money in making the immigration thing work, I guess.
Yeah.
And I just, at that time where I felt I just needed a break, I wanted, you know, I needed to, for my own mental health and also to, I needed to practice. I got to a point in my own creative development where it was very clear that what I needed more than anything else was to practice.
Yeah, and I guess it's tough if you're working so many hours.
It was impossible, almost, you know. I mean, I was playing, I was going to sessions, I was doing sessions at my home a lot. But, yeah, I mean, there's times in your life, people have told me, you know, at various times that, like, you don't really go to New York to practice. You go to New York to play.
Right.
You go to New York to, like, you know, try to make it or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
Just where I was creatively at the time, and I also desired a different kind of pace of life. It was very exhausting.
Yeah.
I mean,
Berlin seems to have a great balance of the whole creative music scene and the fact that everyone's a bit more chilled here. Because I guess I suppose it's true with London in some way. You know, it's like really expensive, and then you have to, like, spend ages traveling everywhere, and it's just so time consuming.
I think it's fascinating, like, the more I travel and the more I make connections with people in different major cities and cultural hubs to see the difference on how people live, like how musicians make a living.
Yeah, totally.
In those places. In some places it's all about teaching. Some places, like London, I really noticed that like function jobbing gigs were a big thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas in Berlin, that's not really so much. It exists, but it's not to this anywhere near the same extent than what
yeah,
I saw in
totally.
London.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or like Toronto, for example. Toronto jobbing gigs is very much like that. In Berlin, it isn't so much, but that kind of creates a sort of a freedom. You don't get the sense that people are like hustling around for gigs in the same way. It's more about like presenting and developing creative projects, which for what I want to do is amazing. You know, it's just a great chance to meet people from all over the world, you know, who've come here and they're amazing at what they do, and the level's super high and,
yeah,
you know, very creatively diverse.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
And the improv scene is huge here.
It's
very separate from the jazz scene, which I, you know, was the first for me in North America. My experience had been that the improvised music scene was very closely tied to the jazz scene. So even though you were playing free improvised music, you were still doing it with people who mostly had done jazz school and had this jazz background. But here it was people coming out of classical or rock or electronic music or whatever, all kinds of things, you know.
Yeah. Cool, man. But so it's all happening in Berlin, man. Sounds great.
Yeah, well, man. So far, so good.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Well, I think we did it.
Yeah.
Cool. Cheers, man. Nice one.
Thanks, man.
There we are. Jonathan Lindhorst. That was a good one. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Big thanks to John for being on the podcast and for the tracks. So the first one was his trio with Matt Adamite and Sly Juhas. I hope I'm saying that right. And the track behind me now is with Ollie Steidler, Jonathan, Dan Peter Sundland, and friend of the podcast, Peter Van Huffel. So this is his group called Fake Noise. So, thanks everyone for listening, and hope you enjoyed, and please tune in to the next one. And big thanks to those of you who have already subscribed on the Patreon. Thanks so much for your support. See you next time. Bye!